John Polkin is going to talk to us about the sermon as behavior change, that behavior change agent, and the implications of the state-dependent learning. And I think it's going to be kind of interesting to see the the connection that you're making with what David's already given us.
I find myself in an uncomfortable position here right now. After being married for 10 years, I've learned that it's usually best not to claim the last word, but I have that here today. What I have to say does follow quite closely some of the things that David had to say on Sunday about the effectiveness of sermons and of public presentations in general in it having any effect on behavior. You may remember he gave us a handout with this diagram on it, which showed various points of decision and whether or not they're going to have any effect on ultimate action. The stage at which my research focuses is the part that I've circled there. I would have circled it more neatly on transparency, but I saw when he handed it out that that was what I was talking about and quickly scribbled it and then realized, not yet, you should have done it more nicely. But it's the point of remembering material that's learned. And so I'm kind of taking a small area of this overall pattern that David had laid down. It seems to me that one of the problems faced by Christians in any era is getting out of the church and into the world. Decisions made in the pew too often fail to affect behavior in the pits, where we work out our faith in our living. The problem can be described as a lack of generalization. That which is learned in one situation, the worship service, is not recalled or acted upon in other situations. The difficulty is analogous to that routinely faced in psychological practice, when a treatment is highly effective in the clinic, but fails to generalize to everyday life. Interesting summary of that in Gary Schwartz's book on learning of this current year. One of the factors involved in predicting generalization is state-dependent learning, or SDL. Now, this is a bit of an esoteric area in that it's not the most common topic in the introductory psychology textbook. I've been pleased to see, since it's my major interest in the last couple of years, it has started to pop up in the intro texts, including the most recent textbook by David Myers. But there actually have been a long series of experiments going back to 1926 demonstrating that the state in which learning occurs becomes a cue for later recall. The state in which learning occurs becomes a cue for later recall. So that if the learning state cues are reinstated at recall, accuracy is better than if the recall state is different from the learning state. So if you learn something while you're wearing a green dress, let's say, then it would be easier for you to remember it later on if you were wearing a green dress than a red dress. That's an absurd example, but it's the only example from my whole paper that you will remember. The state cues may be of many different types. You might have fun imagining yourself in a red dress versus a green dress. The Roman orator Cicero, or Cicero for you classicists, was familiar with state-dependent learning, and he used its principles to aid recall by rehearsing his speeches in the hall in which he was to deliver them. And he attached the organization of his presentations to different components of the hall. So his introduction would be the pillars over by the entry. And then the portico above the Senate would be the next passage of his speech, and so on. So then when it came to time to deliver the speech, all he had to do was look around the hall. There was the introduction of his speech, there was the development, and on through to the denouement. All kept in nice order for him, and all of the cues immediately available to him. He didn't have to remember the cues, and then also remember what was attached to them. The cues were there. The well-known Charlie Chaplin movie, The Millionaire. Any of you see the Charlie Chaplin revival a couple weeks ago on PBS? I missed it too. But if we had watched that, we would have seen this good example. In The Millionaire, out on a drunken binge, the little tramp meets an equally besotted millionaire. And they become fast friends, sharing a park bench for the evening. Then the millionaire invites Charlie home. But on waking the next morning in a more sober state, he doesn't remember Charlie and has him thrown out. That night, again drunk, the two rendezvous and resume their friendly ways. This kind of phenomenon, I used this illustration in doing my research with college students, and they immediately smiled when I gave them that illustration because they all would tell me about friends in high school who had to take their examinations while high on drugs, because that's the way they always were when they were studying. If they came to school and took the exam while they were straight, they got poorer grades than if they took them while they were on drugs. Even though the drugs interfered generally with their capacities, if they were drugged up while they were studying, they would do better if they took the exam drugged than if they took the exam sober. Well, Most of the formal research in state-dependent learning has used two state manipulations, drug-induced states and mood states. Although other studies have used things like submersion, a fellow was here the last couple of sessions, there you are with a diver's t-shirt on, you might be a good candidate for some of this research. Godden and Badley in Great Britain have done a number of studies in which they have people learn word lists underwater, divers, and then have them try to recall them either underwater or above water, and recall is much better if they try to recall in the same state they learned them in, underwater. Sleep is another variable that's been tested, time of day, your arousal level, mental illness. People with manic depressive illness or bipolar disorder, for example, if they learn something while manic, recall it better while manic than if recall is tested in a depressed phase. Even situational context cues, and that's the research that goes back to 1926 by a fellow by the name of Pan. I don't think the Greek god that late in time. How might this phenomenon of state-dependent learning relate to the generalization of sermon-induced behavior change? Well, one of the key factors of successful state-dependent learning is the salience or the outstanding character of the state cues. So if state-dependent learning is the reason for the weak generalization of sermon-induced change, we should be able to identify, I'm taking for granted that sermon generalization is poor, I perhaps should point that out, we should be able to identify powerful and atypical or salient features in the worship service as ones which are not frequently encountered in everyday life. There must be something about the worship service that's different from the rest of life so that recall isn't as likely later as it is in the worship service. Perhaps some of you have experienced, as I have, going to church one Sunday, making great plans, decisions, and attitude changes, going home that week and totally forgetting them, acting completely differently, back in church the next Sunday morning, oh, I could have had a V8. I completely forgot, but now I remember again. And then I feel terribly guilty, of course, for having failed to act on the decisions of the previous week. Well, what might these features of the worship service be? Reasoning from previous research, we could suspect the physical setting, the music, the ambiance, and the presence of the preacher or other significant church-specific individuals. By that, I mean people you see at church but not anywhere else. Drug-induced states, which have been researched widely, are rare in the Christian worship service, although the Native American church might be an interesting exception. They use peyote or mescaline in their worship service. Submersion, such as studied by Badley, does occur in the Christian worship service, but it doesn't last long enough to encompass very much learning. The mood state, however, I think is a likely candidate. Mood state induced in a worship service seems intuitively to be both powerful and atypical. The already mentioned features of setting, music, ambience, and behavior of significant individuals are in fact deliberately calculated to induce an attitude of worship. In fact, we even come out and say, "Let us now calm our hearts before the Lord. Let us get into an attitude of worship." In psychological jargon, an attitude of worship is a mood, a prevailing emotional state, a pervasive emotional state. It should be obvious that the character of the mood induced varies from church to church with the liturgical tastes of pastor and congregation. However, it seems equally obvious that churches from top to bottom in the formal, informal hierarchy strive to produce a state of worship which deviates from the workaday world. Something in worship that's different from everyday life seems to be the focus of this attitude of worship concept. If these assumptions, and they are assumptions, I haven't researched their validity, if these assumptions about the state of worship are true, and if state-dependent learning is a reliable phenomenon, then using the sermon or any other component of the worship service as a means of behavioral change beyond the church will have limited success. All right. On the assumption that the state characteristics of the Christian worship service have primary effects manifested in mood, I set about to measure mood states during services of worship and during everyday situations in order to see if there were indeed characteristic differences. Some of the unusual circumstances that prevail in the college community where I work, right here, made it possible to do this with greater experimental control than might otherwise be feasible. However, experimental control in this is not complete, as you will no doubt see. We have here a fairly homogeneous student population. Unlike what you might find in a state university, our students come from a wide range of denominational backgrounds, but they could fairly and somewhat ambiguously be characterized as evangelicals slightly to the right of center. Sometimes a little more to the right of center. They, along with faculty and staff of the college, who might not be characterized as slightly to the right of center, vary sufficiently in their tastes for worship that the local Wesleyan Church, which is the only show in town, holds two Sunday morning services. The first, meeting at 8:30, is informally structured. There's no choir, the organ is unused, choruses are sung as well as hymns, there's a lot of special music, and accompaniment is as likely to be guitar as piano. Even clothing is less formal. There's a notable absence of ties on the gentleman, for example. The meeting is held in the 400-seat village church. The second service, meeting at the scripturally prescribed hour of 11 o'clock, is formally structured. A large pipe organ dominates the musical parts of the service, both orally and visually. A classical music prelude is typical. There's a robed choir, a formal call to worship, scripture from both Old and New Testaments, and so identified, and a pastoral prayer. Hymns are from the traditional denominational hymnal, and those with choruses or refrains are studiously avoided. Guitars are banned within a 300-yard radius. This meeting is held in the 1,200-seat college chapel. But the two services have one interesting and, for my purposes, useful parallel. The same sermon is delivered by the same pastor. Another useful circumstance of our community is that on 4 days during the week, students and faculty meet for a half-hour chapel service at 11:05 a.m., almost the scripturally prescribed hour. Attendance by the students is required by Scripture. While reasonable efforts are made to be at least respectful, if not outright worshipful in chapel, it is not uncommon to see some students reading newspapers, magazines, or letters, or even doing homework, probably chemistry. Furthermore, the speakers frequently address themes which diverge from those typically found in sermons. Sexuality, economics, and anorexia nervosa have been recent examples. So if the worship service does produce a salient mood state, then these are nearly ideal circumstances for detecting it. Now, let me show you what I used to assess mood. You won't be able to read all this, but I have a larger one that will show you some of the details in it. This just shows you how simple the device is. It's a mood adjective checklist, and mood adjective checklists are historically the most popular way of measuring mood. They're much simpler than going into some of the physiological assessments, and they tend to be more directly related to the psychological components of mood. So what I've done here is to use the most recent, and I think, of course, the best. I wouldn't use it otherwise, would I? Means of assessing mood, and just to add a few extra points in here in my brownie list, this one was devised by my thesis supervisor, Edgar Howarth, and he calls it the Howarth Mood Adjective Checklist. It's derived by factor analysis rather than simply listing adjectives as some of the earlier techniques did, and it ends up giving you 10 separate dimensions of mood, or 10 separate measures of different moods. It's very easily done. It's made up simply of 60 adjectives, and you answer it by identifying how much you feel or do not feel in that particular way. So for each of the words on the list, if you definitely do not feel the way, you leave it blank. If you do not feel that way but not strongly enough to say, I definitely do not, you put a 1, a 2 if you do feel that way, and a 3 if you definitely do feel that way. And then it's scored very simply by, if you'll look down the list, you'll see that every other word goes together in a dimension. So concentrating, clear thinking, intent, aware, clever with it go together to score in the bottom here. Office use only, of course, requisite term as concentration. Okay? So it's a simple little adjective checklist. That ends up then giving you scale scores. This is a little wider than this machine will take. How's that? That's about as close as I can get. Scale scores on each of 10 dimensions, which are factor analytically derived and therefore to some degree independent. But as you scan through the list, you'll see that some of them sort of go together. Some of them are up moods or good things to have. Some of them are down moods. And some of them are obnoxious or otherwise not related to good or bad. It takes about 5 minutes to do this test, and so it's not a thing that's going to disrupt the worship service for very long. I recruited participants from psychology classes, randomly assigned a batch of them to one of the two morning services, gave them all a supply of mood checklists, and asked them to fill one out in each of these situations. In the assigned morning worship service, so that was between subjects, different people in the two services, I asked them to fill it out starting 10 minutes after the sermon commenced. In two chapel services, during 1 week, there were two adjacent chapel services, Tuesday and Wednesday, starting at 20 past 11 each day. In one academic class, it was an abnormal psychology class, made up mostly of seniors, near the end of the period. And in one other class, an experimental psychology class, upon completing an examination. you can see that I was trying to make sure I got some differences in this. They were asked to fill these out quietly and surreptitiously so as not to detract from the worship experiences of others. I got questionnaires back from 15 churchgoers, that was my smallest group, my second smallest group, 18 in Tuesday Chapel, 19 in Wednesday Chapel, 29 in class, and 12 after an exam. Then I scored each of the questionnaires and compared the values across settings. First, I compared the two morning worship services using a student's t-test and then used analysis of variance to make all of the other comparisons. There were no differences between the two worship settings. The early morning setting and the late morning setting showed no differences. Comparison by analysis of variance of the worship services with the two chapels also showed no differences. So in the three worship or quasi-worship settings, we had no significant differences between our in moods on any of these 10 dimensions. So in those three areas, we had pretty much the same kinds of results. When comparing those settings, each of them individually, with the class setting and the exam setting, we started to get what I hoped to get, differences. Started to get differences in the moods. And so now let me summarize for you what those differences looked like. I hope this one will all fit. What I've done here is to take each of the 10 dimensions and then give you the means, the mean mood scale scores for each of the four areas. I combined chapel. They were never different at all. Church, chapel, class, exam. The fifth column gives you the corresponding F ratio for the differences and the probability value rounded, in most cases, to two digits. But you know from looking at papers, at least in psychology, that if you have significance beyond two digits, you like to put the extra digits in there. It somehow makes you feel better inside. It's kind of a mood-elevating device to get significance to three digits. I looked at sex differences, and I can dispose of that quickly. The only sex difference I found consistently was that for all treatment groups, men were higher in concentration. Now, remember, that doesn't mean they were concentrating better. It means they felt more in a concentrating mood. In all of these, keep that in mind. These are such and such mood, not such and such capacity or ability. So the men were more concentrating overall, or in more of a concentrating mood. There were no group differences, however, in concentration. As you can see, an F ratio was less than one. Moving on to depression, the second variable, depression was much higher after an examination than it was in a non-test class or in chapel or church. Now, that shouldn't be very surprising. Perhaps they didn't do too well in that examination, or perhaps they were crashing after all of the exhilaration of taking an exam. Cooperativeness, this one surprised me a little bit. Cooperativeness was highest in class, and this was an 8 o'clock in the morning class too, by the way, middling in chapel and church, and lowest after the exam. I thought that cooperativeness would be highest in the worship setting. It was one of the things I thought we would get out of worship, was a high sense of cooperativeness. The largest F ratio was for sleepiness, and or sleepy mood, I should say, with chapel and church settings lowest, which might be encouraging to some pastors. The class setting, which was discouraging to me since it was my class, was the highest, and the exam setting was a little bit lower, but still high. As might be expected, anxious mood was highest after the exam and low in all of the other settings. A parallel effect was found for anger, with the exam higher than the other settings. But it's noteworthy, and you can look at these figures to see that, it's noteworthy that self-reports of anger in this population are very low, corresponding even in the exam group to a rating on this of, I do not feel that way. So even when the exam made them feel more angry than the rest of the people, they still were saying, no, I don't feel angry, honest, I don't feel angry. I'm a bit suspicious of that. I think it might be an artifact of the kind of student who goes to a Christian college, or the way the student wants to appear to a professor, at least. For optimistic mood, the highest ratings were in chapel and class, with church intermediate and exam lowest. And this was the only variable for which there were detectable differences between church and chapel. In summary, then, we may describe the church-chapel mood state as differing from non-test class or test class settings in these ways. The church state is less depressed than following an exam state, less cooperative than class, but more cooperative than after an exam, less sleepy than class or exam, less anxious than after an exam, slightly less angry than after an exam, and more optimistic than after an exam. As seems obvious in retrospect, but remember David Meyer's warnings about non-surprising results, the biggest mood differences distinguish church or chapel from the exam setting. Less depressed, less sleepy, less anxious, less energy, more cooperative, more optimistic. Less depressed, sleepy, anxious, angry, more cooperative, and optimistic. However, the church-chapel mood was also distinct from the class mood in being less cooperative and less sleepy. There were no reliable differences for the other mood variables of concentration, skepticism, potency, or control or propriety. I was glad not to see differences in skepticism. I had visions of having to present this paper and report that students were much more skeptical in a worship service than they were in class, for example. So at least something about their personality is a bit consistent. What does all of this mean? I don't know yet. This is the first stage in a program of research that will attempt to discover the value of applying state-dependent learning theory to the natural non-laboratory setting. All of the work so far in SDL has been in the lab. Mood seems to be an important variable, one that characterizes most of our day-to-day activities. This first stage of research supports my contention that worship-related settings establish or at least are accompanied by mood states which vary in significant ways from at least two settings prominent in the life of the collegian, class and examination. I must point out what I trust is obvious. These are limited samples formed on the basis of similarity of students, course material, and teacher. I had contact with all of these students. This is not a random sampling of all Houghton College students, much less all college students in the world. There are no doubt other classes in which students would not be nearly so sleepy, for example. Further studies will attempt to broaden the scope of generalization. You always have to say that in a paper. You know that, don't you? With this and the usual scientific caveats in mind, I'll suggest some specific interpretations. The mood prevailing during reaction to an exam, being radically different for whatever reason from that found in church or chapel, is not likely to stimulate recall of decisions and attitudes formulated in church or chapel. This is significant because many Christian students regard their responses to adversity as the true indicator of how well they are living the Christian life. The present research may be of some comfort to them. Second, those directing the worship service should give some thought to associating the mood established when attitudes and decisions are being formed in church, the mood during worship, to the mood likely to prevail when those same attitudes and decisions are supposed to affect behavior. Instead of putting people into a mood which is specific to the worship service and saying, now, whenever things go wrong out in the world, behave this way, we need to make some connection between the mood in church and the mood they're going to be in when the decision comes down to action. If there's no connection, the mood they're in when action takes place is not going to stimulate recall of what they learned in the worship service. This can be done with remarkable success by the use of identification-fostering anecdotes, stories with which we identify, and guided imagery, both of which are routinely employed by preachers for other purposes. So instead of just using anecdotes and guided imagery to help us get into a worshipful state or to laugh at the beginning of the sermon, both of which are good things, I'm not denigrating those, but also these techniques can be used to take a decision-making process during the worship service and make it memorable in the circumstances when the decision will actually produce behavior. Instead of feeling all lovey-dovey and wishy-washy and wonderfully worshipful, now, while I decide that I'm going to always kiss my wife when I'm angry with her, and then I go out and my wife does something and I get angry with her, the last thing I remember is give her a big kiss. Instead, what I need to do is remember when you're angry, this is during the worship service, when you're angry with your wife, when things are going wrong, when the babies are crying, when the ceiling is falling down, when you're feeling that way, still kiss your wife. And then that's more likely to be recalled when I'm out there and feeling that way than if it's worship, lovey-dovey, kiss your wife. Then I'm going to kiss my wife whenever I feel worshipful and lovey-dovey, not when I really need to have that decision changing my behavior. Third and final point, the person in the pew can increase the effect of attitude and decision formation on behavior by striving to maintain or recapture the mood state of the worship service at times when those attitudes and decisions need to be acted out. So I'm saying first, the preacher has to get you in the mood that's going to prevail when the decision has an active effect. And secondly, I'm saying we have the responsibility to try to recapture the mood state of learning when we're in the situation where the decision is to be taken. when we're out in the world, we must try to recall not only what we were taught in the worship service, but how we felt when we were taught it, and how we felt will help us to recall the decisions that we made. This leads to my final point. When a particular mood state is dominant, it is not just the case that material learned in a different state is harder to recall through effort. It's not just that you're sitting there trying to remember, what was it, I can't remember it. But it's also that one is less inclined to try to recall. One is less inclined to attempt to recall other material and may even actively block it. When you are angrily fighting with your spouse or child, the last thing you want to recall is a sermon on loving one's family. That's what you don't want to remember. You keep that out. Instead, you want to win the fight, and you strive to recall anger-associated material, the miss-squeezed toothpaste tube, the dent in the fender, the charge account balance, the poor report card. And once you start, mood stimulates recall, and recall feeds mood. It's hard to stop a fight when it's only just begun. So I close with the words of a well-known hymn. May the mind of Christ my Savior live in me from day to day, by his power and love controlling all I do and say. May the word of God dwell richly in my heart from hour to hour, so that all may see I triumph only through his power. Thank you for your attention. Good group. You all stayed awake. I put my abnormal psych students to sleep, but you stayed up.
Created the right mood. What questions you might have?
Oh, boy, you've got a lot of questions.
Yes, sir.
You choose. I wonder if you thought about the implications of this with regard to the method of teaching that Jesus used. He seemed to try to teach people in something more closely approximated
yes.
life settings.
Yes. Yes, I hadn't thought of that. Someone mentioned it, or I saw an abstract of a paper. Was it your paper?
No.
No, someone was giving a paper that pointed to some of that idea here. I think certainly Christ was an excellent teacher in that regard. Notice he didn't teach in a church setting, typically. He taught out where the people were, by the lake, the setting cues for this. So where you're out there hauling in the fish is where yesterday Jesus was saying, love your fellow man. Yeah, so that's a good point. Yeah, I think I'll add that. Thank you.
Mm.
When I started collecting this data, that was my goal. In fact, a lot of it is within subjects, but it's a bit of an orphan kind of design. I started out, I wanted to have my two church settings between subjects and then pull through within subjects across that. What I have is within subjects for church versus chapel, the two times, versus abnormal psych class. And in those, the number of participants who returned, this was all voluntary, number of participants who returned didn't really justify that kind of more sustained analysis. I'm a bit encouraged, though, because of the I used with that between subjects analysis of variance, which is a little bit more conservative than the within subjects would be. So I would be able to extract more of my error variance with a within subjects design. Yeah, that's a good observation. Any others? Irma. Yeah, by the way, the maximum on these is 18. So.
Well, in a sense, no, he said this was an 8 o'clock in the morning class, but I was wondering if you would do it between other classes, otherwise in the day, and are you going to try to test under similar circumstances? Of course, they'll all be taking the test
mm-hmm.
at
yeah.
8 o'clock in the morning because that's the way those things go, except for final exams.
Yes, that would be a good opportunity to do that. I was really happy about the chapel service. See, that all lines up nicely with the worship service time. But the class time, we don't have any class time during the 11 o'clock hour because that's when everybody goes to chapel. So I'm a bit stuck there with our local circumstances. But I do want to generalize it into other classes and see if time of day has that kind of an effect, particularly on sleepiness. I hope it was the time and not my lecture.
Did you say which of the two church services you took the test in?
Both of them. I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. Yes, I had one group of students take it in the early service, another group took it in the later service. They were very similar results, yes. So it's more of a generalized worship service effect than a specific pattern of worship, it seems, from that limited sample. Remember, two services. I would want to extend that to other churches and other communities, and maybe even in some real-life cities, look for those effects.
How about the charisma of the pastor?
Well, that was the beauty of this that I liked. It was the same pastor in the same setting, so I could make those comparisons. But yes, that's when you start getting out of the laboratory, you lose control. That's greater generality and less control. Ma'am?
And I think that they've been forced to go to the opposite service than the one that they wanted to be in.
Right.
They might have gotten very different results. Yeah. Everybody was mm-hmm. in the service they wanted to be in. So So why would they be so discontent?
Oh, no.
You know what I'm saying? They chose a form of service they wanted to be a part of.
Well, I...
So I don't know what the results show.
Well, I didn't make it clear, but I forced them into the service. I randomly assigned participants to the two morning services. Yes. I'm sorry. I should have made that clear. Yeah, I forced them to, which meant, of course, that some of them ended up where they wanted to be, some of them where they didn't want to be, and some of them didn't want to be in church at all. That could maybe. There you go. There you go. Yeah. I noticed that there were a couple of guys who had typical scores in everything except anger. They were angry. So I figured they were the ones I must have coerced into going, getting them out of bed in the morning or something. Okay. Well, thank you for your responses. They've been most helpful.